It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. The prominent word on the Sick Temple of Wisconsin website is welcome. And that word resonates as you see all the ways this Sangat, this Sick Fellowship community, it continues to open up, continues to welcome community members in healing, in love. And today, this weekend, the series of events at the temple centered on the theme of Heal, Unite, Act, 10 years after a white supremacist opened fire on a gurdwara, this house of worship. Join in what is coming up, 800-642-1234. Pardeep Kalika is an expert in hate prevention and de-radicalization. He is executive director of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee, where faith leaders come together to build community. Pardeep, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's an honor to be on.
You are a trustee of the temple, an integral part of the Sikh community. What are you hearing from fellow members of the community on this day?
Yeah, I think just, it's been 10 years. There's a lot of just, they can't believe it's been 10 years. Mm-hmm. For some people, it feels like yesterday. And I'm hearing just a lot of hope and gratitude from the Sangat itself of just all of the work that has been done, the appreciation for that work. And as you pointed out, our small Sangat feels like it's become a larger Sangat. We are genuinely grateful.
Mm. August 3rd, Wednesday, was your birthday. And 10 years ago, that was the last time that you would see your father alive. And I think about, birthday celebrations, mm-hmm. being so close together with death. And I think about how your birthdays won't ever be the same. How do you hold that?
Yeah, no, thank you for, August 3rd, I saw my dad alive. It was his 65th year on this planet, and I think that he was celebrating a recent retirement himself. And my dad and I, and I think this is true for lots of parents who have come over, first generation, second generation, there's a difficulty in assimilation and how that feels like and what that looks like, especially as you wrestle with identity and language and just everything that comes along with that. And by that time, I remember like a clear recollection of we had made it. We had achieved what we wanted to achieve. And I was genuinely just proud of my father, of what he had done coming to America in 1982, especially Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And at that time, I think that we were just appreciating life. And one of my last final memories of him was of him and his two grandchildren really giving piggyback rides in the middle of the living room. And I had this other memory of like, where was that? Where was this type of father when I was growing up? Mm. And I realized that he had to hold so much as a first generation immigrant just to make it. And now he was able to kind of celebrate his grandchildren and his life.
How would your father feel today? Look at your anti-hate work that you've done over the past decade.
Yeah, I know my father would be proud. And I know he would be proud and just look at it as a continuation of the work that he started to do. When he came over, I know that there's a part of him that wrestled with creating a place of sanctuary for the broader community. The money that he made kind of was dedicated towards that Sikh temple, what we call a gurdwara, and really creating a place for people to come, pray, marry, grieve all together. And by the time that he had passed, I know that he knew that. And obviously he passed in the place that he helped build. Mm. For Sikhs, there's no greater death nor life to be able to build that type of sanctuary and to be able to die or pass fighting for that same place of sanctuary that you helped to build. And so really, I think that he would take my work as just a continuation of that same struggle and fight.
We're talking with Pardeep Kalika, Father, was killed in the Sikh temple of Wisconsin mass shooting in Oak Creek 10 years ago today. Pardeep has dedicated himself to hate prevention and executive director of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. You can join in 800-642-1234. The temple is having, you know, memorials and education events, conference-type activities, and a candlelight vigil, but also this 48-hour continuous prayer service. What are you praying about today?
This year, you know, 10 years after what happened, we're praying for a continuation and a dedication towards creating a safer society, not just for the Sikh community, but for the entire community. And much of our messaging is, yes, it's around Chardi Kala, but this year we have a special emphasis on another phrase, which is Sarbat Tabla. And Sarbat Tabla is, you know, part of that phrase of let's work for peace and prosperity for all mankind. So Sarbat Tabla literally translates to for all of mankind. And I think this year is really about that part of what are we going to do 10 years from now? How can we look back in 20 years? And there's been so much work that we have accomplished along with communities, passing policies, and, you know, just helping to change institutions, that I really think the work that we want to do going forward is really changing hearts and minds and what that all feels like.
In the context of For All of Mankind, you do therapy for people who are, you know, they've been lured by extremist ideologies. You've worked with former white supremacists and Islamists and eco-terrorists. What do you learn from them?
You know, one of the things that I learned from them is just how prevalent pain can be in one's life, what those grievances can lead a person to do. And the other part of it is I just how courageous people can be to get out of that life. And for me, it was a continuous journey of trying to go upstream. People ask, like, why is it that you are called to do this work? Why not somebody else who hasn't sort of suffered the same type of tragedy that you have suffered? And I let them know that I'm looking for the next Wade Page. I know that there are people out there that are like him, and we can do this work. We can create a society where people can be a bit more attuned to what pain and rejection are causing in a person, and what those grievances are causing in a person, and how do we de-escalate that? You know, how do we de-escalate hate? How do we off-ramp somebody? So, for me, it's been, I've been both in a strange way blessed by the life that I get to lead in getting further upstream and not being so responsive to hate and sort of the aftermath, is that I know that there has been numerous incidents that we have prevented and families that do not have to grieve because we have been able to off-ramp that person.
Pardeep Kalika, expert in hate prevention and de-radicalization, trustee of the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin, integral member of the community, trusted representative. Join in on ways to prevent hate. What is happening in your community? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. August 5th, 2012. We reflect, we listen, we remember lives lost. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Sikh Temple of Wisconsin, it remains the deadliest act of anti-Sikh hate in U.S. history. The work of this Sangat, this congregation, is to heal, to unite, and stand in solidarity with other faith communities that have fallen victim to mass gun violence and white supremacy. Join in 800-642-1234. Pardeep Kalika is a Sikh temple trustee. He leads the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee, a clinician with Parents for Peace, and founded Serve to Unite, and stays with us. Pardeep, as we talk about disrupting extremism, disrupting hate, what contributes to extremism? What can you point to?
That's a great question. And there's different forms and different levels of extremism. But I think a lot of times what leads to it is a sense of loneliness, a want for identity, purpose, and what we call, you know, belonging. So we start to look at some of those things and, you know, certain kids are a bit more prone, certain young men, and I'll be very specific on that, that most of our cases do involve young men, you know, within 18, 19, 20, 21. And some types of personalities are just a bit more prone to it. So there's lots of variables, but a sense of what we start to look at is a sense of grievances and rejection, whether they are real or not. It doesn't really matter to that person. They're real to that person. And so the sense of persecution and all of that starts to lead this person into searching for why am I being persecuted? And there's no shortage of answers on social media and the internet for them to find those answers. And oftentimes that leads them to a place where they continuously get siloed and brainwashed, quite honestly. I think that's what kind of leads people into different types of ideologies of extremism.
I think what you're saying there about social media and the internet, finding echo chambers, perhaps, what impact is that having on this work to stop hate crimes? You know, that whole element of the digital world.
It makes it extremely difficult. You know, as opposed to, I've worked with other white supremacists and stuff before. You know, years past, you would have to throw out leaflets at a place where they're having racial tensions. Well, now the entire, digital world becomes a leaflet, and you're throwing them out and finding disgruntled kids, and then seeing how far they go into that. So it's the work is extremely difficult, and you know, Twitter, Facebook, all of these social media engines understand just how difficult it is. And they have dedicated cybersecurity that is directed at just seeing those threats.
For years, the Sikh community and the Sikh coalition, they've pushed authorities to recognize and track anti-Sikh hate crimes. And the FBI, as you know well and know, agreed to do so, to begin tracking these incidents in 2015. What difference has that made?
A huge difference. Since they've been tracking that, we found that in the past 10 years, since the 2012 attacks, that Sikhs are overly represented as targets of hate, along with the Jewish community, the Muslim community, the LGBTQ community, and the Black community. And so tracking hate crimes or hate bias incidents against Sikhs has led to the allocation of resources dedicated towards prevention. So it's made a huge difference.
When you see that allocation of resources toward prevention, what is the top priority? Where should it go to?
The top priority, I think, really needs to go into, like, what does prevention look like from a whole of society approach? Meaning that law enforcement, DOJ officials, cannot do this work alone. They cannot do this work without community stakeholders, nonprofits, media. We all have a stake in all of our neighborhoods. And a lot of times when you have a localized focus, that those local communities can be really attuned to what hate looks like and how hate may be escalating against a targeted community within those particular communities. So I think the work really needs to go from a federal level to much more of a local level. Not that the federal level is, you know, there's good in that as well, but it also needs to go to over-reliance of law enforcement entities to more of a whole of society approach.
You mentioned law enforcement. Would harsher penalties or more enforcement of hate crime laws help reduce hate crimes?
I think they would. I just don't think they would to the extent that we need them to. I don't know if a person who is committing hate is really thinking about all of the, you know, the severity of the punishment. Lots of times when we see people getting into some of this stuff, they don't know exactly how far in they are because they're being groomed a lot of times to hate and hate and hate. So sometimes that rage kind of gets in the way of your intellect or your kind of like logic. So I don't know if the logic of harsher sentences and penalties would have as much of an effect as we would deem them to. I also think that they would have some effect. So, I mean, it's I guess it's too early to tell, but I think that we need to take a bit more of a proactive approach than a reactive approach.
Pardeep Kalika with us works in the space of hate prevention and de-radicalization, executive director of the Interfaith Conference of Greater Milwaukee. And his father was killed 10 years ago today in the mass shooting at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin in Oak Creek. You can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Sarah in Whitewater. Sarah, hi. What would you like to bring up?
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much. I'm enjoying this discussion so very much. And I would like to extend my deepest sympathies for the loss of your father and what a horrible tragedy we went through in Milwaukee. I was living in Milwaukee at the time. And I just wanted to mention, and I'd like to know some thoughts. I've always considered social media a tool, and we have an opportunity to use social media for good as well as we use it for hate. And this previous few words you were mentioning about harsher sentences, etc., I do agree, and yet the proactive approach, as you mentioned, makes a lot of sense. Is there a way, or what are your thoughts, that we could turn these tools that we have into tools for good? And is there something that we can do? I'm sure there's many people sitting around hearing this who agree very much with what you're saying. And I'm happy to take those comments off the air, and I thank you so much.
Oh, Sarah, thank you so much. Pardeep.
Yes, sir. That's a great question. And I think that you're right. I think that these are tools, and tools can be used for good, and tools can be manipulated to be used for bad. Oftentimes when you have a young, disgruntled person, they may be using it for bad without them really knowing that they are, because they're searching for answers on why they feel depressed, why they feel sad, why they may feel suicidal. And so they get online and start the search of like why they can make sense of their grievances. And what they start to find is sort of this world that tells them that they're justified to have these grievances. And so, you know, this particular group is to blame for that. So I think that it can be used for good. We have to be really careful in the way that we use it, how we teach the next generations on how to do research, how to find things that are not only credible, but find things that are filling their heart with goodness rather than disgruntlement. So I think that you are right. It is just, I think the thing that parents and loved ones can do is really be attuned to your children and see how long there's like, how much time are they spending on the internet? What are they searching? There's lots of different internet platforms that may seem very, very like innocent. But then the further that they get into them, you know, we've had parents who didn't know that their kids were making guns or bombs or other things. Mm. They didn't know to the extent that they were being radicalized or being groomed. They didn't know that the trips that they were taking into the middle of the woods was them being manipulated and trafficked into some of these gangs or groups. So I think be attuned to your children.
In our last few moments together, picking up on what Sarah said, how can we be better allies? How can we support the Sikh community?
I just think tonight, tonight's going to be a very special night for the entire Sikh community, not just in Wisconsin, but in the United States and in the world. And I come to the vigil, show up to the vigils, show support for your Sikh neighbors. It's not lost on us that tonight, a former disgraced president, and I don't mean to be political, but decided to hold a rally 25 minutes away in Waukesha. And that, and then we talk about this issue of white supremacy and just kind of what it feels like. It is not lost on anybody, just the dynamics of racism and hate that are happening in this country. So I think that, choose what kind of America you want to see. Tonight at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin, you will see a community come together. And again, like as we unite, as we heal, as we act towards the betterment of society, or are we supporting something that is much more divisive and much, much more dangerous?
Pradeep Kalika on the Ideas Network. All this morning, we remember Oak Creek here on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We memorialized 10 years ago today the tragedy of the mass shooting at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin and discover how its members embody Charikala, or eternal optimism, in healing. Join in 800-642-1234. Crystal Woodman Miller is here, serves on the Survivor Advisory Council for the Triumph Over Tragedy Retreat for Mass Shooting Survivors. She survived the Columbine High School mass shooting on April 20th, 1999, and views herself as an advocate of hope. Crystal, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, among the feelings people could grasp after tragedies like mass shootings, there are many feelings, but why do you advocate for hope?
Yeah, that's such a good question. And it's a question that you there in Wisconsin understand, especially today. My heart is with your community there, just remembering 10 years ago today, just your community being shaken by violence. And we are seeing this become so commonplace in our world. And I just feel such an urgency to bring that hope so that people know that violence and tragedy, they are not the end. They don't have the last say. Hope does, that there is ability to live beyond and to thrive beyond these things that happen to us. And that is the message that I carry.
How do you find hope?
You know, I think it looks different for so many different people. I personally, I'm a person of faith. That is a place where I find hope, but also I find hope in other people's stories. We are so connected by story, and we can really find inspiration and encouragement to live when we listen and we know other people's stories. I love traveling around and meeting people of different cultures and different backgrounds and different genders and socioeconomic status, and just entering in, because I think when we know other people's stories, we cannot hate another person. We cannot find reasons to be divided, but rather we can find commonalities and common ground that make us more alike than we are different. For me, hope has been traveling around the world, finding people who live far more difficult circumstances than I ever have, and realizing that if they can find hope to carry on, then so can I. Hope is also found for me in speaking and writing. Just finding beauty all around. I mean, I believe there's hope. If we go out and we look for it, we can find hope in so many different places.
You've lived through these types of anniversaries, and I'm wondering, what do 10-year anniversaries of mass shootings, 20-year anniversaries, what do those days feel like?
You know, those days, of these anniversaries, they they are so sacred. They're so important to remember the people that we lost, but also those who survived, those who are still here, who are dealing with the pain and the trauma and the loss and the grief and the joys. I think that these days truly represent a solemn day of reflection. And again, that's going to look so different for every single person who has been affected by an event. But I think it really shows that we will never forget what we went through. But with each passing year that we really start to see hope and to see change and to see forward progress in our lives. And so I think that this day should be spent, you know, however someone sees fit. Some people like to go somewhere and not think about it at all. And some people love to sit where it happened and reflect. I think it's such a personal experience. For me, it's really just a looking back while also looking forward and kind of sitting in the emotions of that day and not letting it pass me by. It's realizing that the lives who were lost will always be a part of us. It's remembering that our lives were forever changed in an instant. And then it's really deciding how we're going to choose to respond to that. Are we going to allow it to just devastate us and destroy us? Or are we going to allow it to kind of propel us and move us forward?
Do you think, Crystal, that public memorials or other places of memorials of these mass shootings, are they helpful in that a journey of healing?
I can only speak from experience, Kate. Mm-hmm. In my experience, I really believe that it has been helpful for us in the Columbine community in Littleton, Colorado. We were able to create a memorial after the shootings at Columbine High School. And I can say from personal experience that I go there often. I spend a lot of time at the memorial. I think it's such a beautiful place to reflect and to remember. It's a place of gathering where I get to be with other people in my community who experience something similar. But I also respect and I honor those who feel as though it's too difficult to go to the memorial, those who feel as though it's just too painful of a reminder. And so again, we all experience grief in such unique ways. No two people experience trauma in the same way. And so I just want to hold space for those as well who do not feel as though that's healing or helpful, because I think we all journey through grief in such vastly different ways.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the work of hope and healing decades after a mass tragedy. Crystal Woodman Miller is with us, a survivor of the Columbine High School shooting of 1999, serves on the Survivor Advisory Council for the Triumph Over Tragedy Retreat for Mass Shooting Survivors. You can join in 800-642-1234. Crystal, let's look at Triumph Over Tragedy and this retreat that happens next month, mid-September. It is free for mass shooting survivors. What sparked the creation of the retreat?
Yes, you know, this retreat was created because there is nothing else like this program anywhere in the world. There's very few tools and resources for survivors of mass shootings. And so we were able to team up with the OnSite Foundation in order to give survivors a place that they can come. It's a week long or a 6-day rather healing trauma retreat that takes place within community. There's also this beautiful educational component so people can understand the effects of trauma and why they're how it manifests and why they're living, thinking, doing things that they never really can understand understand. And it's because trauma has these effects on our bodies and it manifests in various ways. And so we're giving people that ability to understand and to operate and to find tools for hope and healing. But it's done within the context of community, because we believe that healing takes place within community, that we were made for relationship and we were made for one another. So people come, they come to Nashville, Tennessee. And as you said, Kate, it is free to all, regardless of race or socioeconomic status, background, gender, that it has been provided for free by generous donors, because we believe that everybody should have access to best-in-class trauma therapy. And we have the experts in trauma, and they can come and they walk through. It's intense. It's an intensive, but it's done in such a gentle and tender way. And it's such a beautiful, quiet campus. And we walk through a series of using a variety of different modalities. Modalities are simply a fancy way of just different types of therapy. We use these different modalities because we've really recognized that talk therapy, it doesn't do much for trauma, that we need to unlock the trauma that we as survivors that we're holding. And so different modalities allow us to do that, whether it's psychodrama therapy, or it's adventure therapy, or body movement therapy. We also use various brain spotting, EMDR techniques, all of these things that are proven to really help begin to move the trauma out of our bodies and to begin to experience healing and hope like never before.
I'm wondering, as you say, you know, trauma manifests differently for every individual, but being at this retreat and being in the presence of mass shooting survivors, I wonder if there's a uniting quality, even if their atrocity occurred years before or decades before in a completely different situation. What is that uniting quality like?
You know, among survivors, Kate, I think that's one of the most beautiful things that we see is we have this bond that cannot be broken. This bond among survivors, we don't have to sit and unpack our trauma and all of the nuances, because we know we can understand and relate with what one another has gone through. And so it's this beautiful just understanding that we can sit in one another's presence and we get it. We understand, we have this shared language and this shared experience, even if it was decades apart and vastly different, that there is a beautiful community among survivors. We're part of a club, and in this club, you will always feel known and seen, and you will have a place of belonging. And I think that is what matters most.
Crystal Woodman-Miller with us assists in curating the Triumph Over Tragedy program through the OnSite Foundation, their retreat set for next month. She is a Columbine survivor. Join in on this journey of healing after gun violence. Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Over the course of this morning, we've been remembering 10 years since a gunman opened fire in the Sikh temple in Oak Creek, and the work to prevent hate and violence in sacred spaces that continues on today. We have insight from Crystal Woodman-Miller, an advocate and author, survivor of the Columbine High School mass shooting, serves on the Survivor Advisory Council for the Triumph Over Tragedy Retreat, created by the OnSite Foundation. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234 to join in. Crystal, survivors of mass tragedies, they can feel a range of emotions, as you've talked about, and one is survivor's guilt. How do you address those feelings at the retreat?
Yes, that is a big one that every one of us has faced at some point in our healing journey. And you know what's so beautiful? We were talking before the break that you know, because we're all on this journey, there's no timeline to heal or what it should look like or when you have to deal with a certain issue. But that is certainly something that we work through. And it's done in such a way that, it's not a one-on-one, as I said, session, but rather within group. And so it's a lot of stuff is talked about out loud and it's processed as they go. And various people will jump in and say, well, here's how I dealt with it, or here's my experience, you know. And then, of course, we have an expert in trauma who is leading the conversation, and they're able to interject and to jump in with really wise counsel and tools of, okay, if you're experiencing some survivor's guilt, here's some things that you can do. Here's some things that you can try. Sometimes it looks like maybe writing a letter to somebody or to yourself or to somebody who has passed, being able to say goodbye and to express your survivor's guilt and to say, I'm so sorry you're gone and I'm still here. I mean, it's hard to answer that question because again, mm-hmm. And it's dealt with in a variety of different ways, depending on who you are and where you are in the process. I will say for me, Kate, that survivor's guilt for me, it was something that just had a grip on me and just controlled me so much after the shootings at Columbine. And I was 16 years old. I was so young and I didn't have a manual to deal with this. And even if we did, it wouldn't apply. But I remember just, I felt so guilty every time I would laugh or smile or feel like I was moving forward with my life because in some way, maybe I was forgetting about those who passed. And I was sitting at the home of one of my classmates, one of my friends who was killed. And I expressed this to her parents and I said, I'm so sorry because I just feel so guilty every time I smile and I laugh and because she cannot, you know, and I can, it's not fair. And they looked at me and they said, the best way that you can honor her life, Crystal, is to live yours. Mm. And that kind of gave me the permission to move forward and to continue to live my life. And I did so with a fresh perspective, recognizing that I could carry her legacy on and I could live well so that I could honor her life. And so it, again, we all have those stories. We all have those moments, but we get to share those at Triumph Over Tragedy and we get to share other experiences like it. And it's so amazing to hear the stories time and time again of somebody who's gone through the program and they were so timid. They were so afraid. They didn't know what was going to happen during the program. And they walk out different people with a new outlook on life. They have a new lease on life and they have this hope to say, okay, it still hurts and the pain is still there and the loss is still great. But I know that there is hope on the other side and that it's okay to walk into hope.
6 days is, I would imagine, a progression, a real journey for the participants. What is that leaving like on the last day?
Well, leaving, Kate, you leave with a chosen family. You know, we don't always get to choose the families that we're born into, but we do get to choose the people who get to enter our stories and who can walk with us through the ups and downs. And I know for me, I've been through the program several times, and every time I leave with these incredibly deep connections, friends that I know I can call on when things get hard or difficult or the emotions that I am faced with. I know that I can reach out and they can do the same in me. And so you have this tight-knit community that these forever friends. And so you walk out knowing, okay, I'm not alone. I don't have to do this alone. And I think that's such an important component of hope, is to recognize that this is not a journey that we have to do alone. It's not an individual journey, though it is, because we do things in such an individual way, but we also get to do so in the context of community. And I just believe that's so important. We need one another, because where I am weak in an area, somebody else may be strong. And where somebody else is weak, I may be strong. And we find this beautiful synergy in that.
Talking about forgiveness and hope with Crystal Woodman Miller, survived Columbine High School mass shooting of 1999 and serves on the Survivor Advisory Council for the Triumph Over Tragedy Retreat for Survivors we've been talking about. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Crystal, I want to bring up Sue Klebold, the mother of the Columbine shooter, and we had her on our program in 2017 when her book came out, A Mother's Reckoning. You say you have compassion for Sue. Can you talk about that?
Oh, I do. I have such compassion for Sue. I also reached out to her when her book came out. I was so desperate to track her down. I've always wanted to chat with her and talk to her and just tell her that I know she did the best that she could possibly do with her son. I know, as a mom myself of three young kids, we pour love. We do everything we can to love our kids and to help nurture our kids and to give them every opportunity and to love them well. And I was able to do that with Sue. I was able to tell Sue, hey, I don't blame you. I know you did the best that you could do, that there is forgiveness, not only for her, but for her son. I came to a place in my own journey where I needed to choose forgiveness for those two shooters. They were gone. They ended their own lives. And instead of being shackled and tethered to these two people who wanted to kill and to destroy my life, I had to release myself because I was just carrying them around and carrying that burden. And so I was able to let that go, and I was able to find release and find life and find freedom from that. And so I expressed these things to Sue, and we were able to kind of go back and forth on email a couple of times. And I know it brought me great comfort, and I pray that it did the same for her as well.
Crystal, thank you for joining us.
Of course. Thank you, Kate, for having me, and thank you for this beautiful program. My heart continues to be with your community today.
Crystal Woodman Miller serves on the Survivor Advisory Council for the Triumph Over Tragedy Retreat, a Columbine survivor, and now remembering the lives lost at the Sikh Temple of Wisconsin. Savan Singh Kalika, 65, Prakash Singh, 39, Sita Singh, 41, Sajit Singh, 49, Shuveng Singh Katavra, 84, Parmajit Kaur, 41, Baba Punjab Singh, 72. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.